Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Senate Bill 819, passed by the Oregon Legislature in 2021, is a law that allows for resentencing of a person serving time if the court finds that the sentence no longer advances the interests of justice. My guest is Karen Neuwirth, special counsel with the Fair Law Project, a project of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Karen, Senate Bill 819, it's a new law in Oregon. What is this bill about?
Senate Bill 819 is what is commonly referred to as a second look statute. It's a statute that gives people who are currently incarcerated or have been convicted of crimes but finished their sentence the opportunity to have their sentence looked at again and reconsidered. The bill works by having the person who's hoping to get a second look write to or apply to the district attorney in the county where they were sentenced and ask for relief. That district attorney then has to agree that the person is entitled to relief, and then a joint petition will be filed with a court, which will then hold a hearing and decide whether or not the person seeking relief should get it. Now, the statute provides for all sorts of relief. So, for example, a person could be resentenced to a shorter sentence. A person could have their conviction vacated and be released. If the person has completed their sentence but is experiencing collateral consequences such as difficulty finding employment or housing or having a hard time doing things around their kid's school or other volunteer activities, they can have the conviction vacated and so it will no longer be on their record. The person's conviction could be vacated and reduced to either a crime that can be expunged or a crime with less serious consequences. They can then be resentenced to a shorter period of time. And of course, under any of these scenarios, if it's available, they can be released from prison early.
So Karen, let's go back to the district attorney, the sentencing prosecutor in the case. Now, it is up to his or her discretion whether you can even apply for this 819 relief. And I understand that the district attorney can also impose further requirements than the county is requiring. So talk more about the district attorney and their discretion in this bill.
So the statute is available to people who've been convicted of felonies, except for aggravated murder, and who are not currently eligible for expungement under the expungement statute in Oregon, ORS 137.225. And let me just say now that our project has a resource page, which I think could be very helpful to your listeners. It's ojrc.info/819. So the statute itself puts very few limitations on who is theoretically eligible for 819. District attorneys then can create their own policies because, as you say, they have complete discretion in who is entitled to relief. And so those policies can add additional and significant requirements that may make it very, very difficult for folks to get relief. And as you just said, relief is not even going to be an available option unless and until the district attorney's office where the person was sentenced agrees that they should be entitled to relief.
And I understand that the Oregon District Attorney Association did not oppose Senate Bill 819 because I'm assuming that they do hold all the power.
100% correct. And this is something that we're very concerned about. As you've covered, as I'm sure your listeners are very aware, prosecutorial discretion is one of the features of our system, which causes the greatest disparity in outcomes for folks, which even more deeply entrenches racist outcomes in the system, because where folks live and what the policies and practices of individual prosecutors can really shape the different outcomes from region to region within the state. And so one of the concerns that we have is that across the state, otherwise similarly situated people, some will be entitled to relief and get relief while others don't. We're concerned, especially because in the counties where folks have been sentenced most harshly, they are probably going to be least likely to get this relief. So we are very interested. We hope that won't be the case. And we plan to collect data to try to understand how 819 is implemented over the next 12 and 24 months. But yes, this complete exercise of discretion is very concerning.
Again, Karen, talk about what types of crimes are not eligible under 819.
So first of all, it's only felonies that are not aggravated murder. So misdemeanors are not available, and obviously aggravated murder convictions are not available. And again, this is under the statute. The statute also says if your conviction is eligible for expungement, you're not eligible for 819 relief. And if you look on our webpage, we have a handy chart about when your criminal record is eligible for expungement. But briefly, you know, that relates to time periods. So how much time has passed from your most recent conviction is what governs expungement.
Now, does this apply to Measure 11 or other mandatory minimum sentencing laws or sentences in Oregon?
So that's really going to turn on this expungement question. Most of those crimes are ineligible for expungement. So yes, 8-1, as long as it's not aggravated murder, then in theory, yes. But when you look at the policies that are being implemented, even in the most liberal counties, and again, not sorry to keep referring to our website, but they're really, we have put together a ton of information, including a chart which describes all of the different county by county policies and then links out to those policies. Even in the most, let's say, under the most liberal policies, those policies acknowledge that person crimes, sexual type of crimes, and other crimes of person-to-person violence are only going to be considered in the most rare instances.
So in Clackamas County, it says on your list that a conviction under Measure 11 will only be considered in the rarest of circumstances. So what does that mean?
Well, so, you know, we don't really know, right? This, as you mentioned, this law was only recently passed. And so we're going to have to wait and see what that means. What I anticipate is that those kinds of crimes are going to, it means what it says. Only in very rare circumstances will people be able to get 819 relief. You know, I think that we can look at the Clackamas County policy and our summary of it. It's a good example of a policy that adds numerous restrictions. So, for example, only a person who has served 50% of their originally imposed sentence is eligible in Clackamas County. If a person owes outstanding victim restitution, they're not going to be eligible in Clackamas County. If there was a criminal conviction subsequent to the crime that's being, for which SB 819 relief is being sought, or if the person has pending charges, they're not eligible in Clackamas County. You know, that the person has previously made this kind of request, they won't be eligible. And that the person, if they were sentenced to probation, they've not successfully completed probation or had probation revoked. So just those kind of initial additional requirements are going to seriously narrow the pool of people who are eligible in that county. The policy goes on to say that they're not going to consider any case involving any level of murder, any level of first degree rape, sodomy, or unlawful sexual penetration, and, you know, so on. So this is an example of, you know, the folks who have gotten the longest sentences are going to be knocked out in most cases by any number of those requirements.
And Karen, you said earlier that you will be working for further legislation on this. So there'll be ongoing work, working on the details of this law. And would that be one of them, to try to make these requirements uniform across the state? Because as you said, every county is so different.
I don't know. I can't speak to exactly what the future legislative or policy strategy will be, but we've been in contact with community groups. We co-hosted a community training with Don't Shoot Portland and have talked a lot about the need for folks who were sentenced in a way that was excessive or unfair or doesn't serve legitimate goals of punishment or no longer makes sense for any number of reasons, for those people to get relief or to at least be able to have their case considered by a court without the gatekeeping of prosecutors. So my personal hope is in the future that the legislature will see that it's important to have the avenue that's provided by 819, the avenue that's provided by the expungement statute, but also an avenue where people can actually come before a court and have their case considered whether or not the prosecutor agrees that relief is appropriate. But that is absolutely a project for the future.
So let's talk more about who is eligible and under what circumstances they can get relief under Senate Bill 819.
First of all, most important is where a person was sentenced is going to drive who is eligible. So I encourage anyone who's interested in listening to look at the policy for the county where the sentence took place to figure out eligibility. Currently, there are a handful of counties that don't have policies, but leaving those aside. So there are sort of three types of relief that can be sought under this bill. One is relief from the conviction or sentence. So a person who has, you know, there are reasons why the sentence that was imposed some time ago no longer advances the interest of justice. So it could be that, you know, the person shows great rehabilitation, you know, that they're not going to commit future additional crimes, that they, you know, there are other detriments to their remaining incarcerated, harms to loved ones, the community, and so on. So those might be reasons why 819 relief is appropriate for those folks. I mentioned also folks who are suffering collateral consequences. So people who have completed their sentence and are still in some way or another held back by their criminal record. And that expungement may not be an option for them today because either the crime is not eligible for expungement because, for example, it's an A felony, or because the requisite amount of time has not yet passed and they're trying to work or get housing or whatever it is. So SB 819 relief might be available for them. At least one county has also said that 819 relief is appropriate for folks who have a claim of actual innocence. Multnomah has three separate application processes, one for excessive sentence, one for collateral consequences, and one for actual innocence. But in any county, a person who has a claim of actual innocence may find relief through 819. Their conviction could be vacated as a result of new evidence of innocence. Maybe that's a general way of answering, but in terms of specific people, the details of the nature of the crime and so on will be determined by the county, you know, by the district attorney in the county where they were sentenced.
Do victims have a say?
Yes. So the statute does mandate that victims should be consulted, and different district attorneys are interpreting that or including that in their policies in different ways. So, for example, some district attorneys will only move forward with considering 819 relief if a victim affirmatively agrees that it's appropriate, while others are simply informing victims or, you know, advising them or hearing from them, but not necessarily giving them an up or down vote. Just to return to this question about priorities. So Deschutes County's policy is an interesting example. And I think a very good example. So in that case, the only additional requirement that the county has imposed is that the case is not on direct appeal. The policy does indicate that any case resulting from a conviction involving child sex abuse or domestic violence will be rarely eligible. But then it goes on to identify a number of priorities. And so those can include cases that were what's known as Boyd delivery cases that involved areola boteo stops or that were improperly merged. And so those deal with cases that the Oregon Supreme Court has decided in the last couple of years. Just to add on, I mean, that policy also talks about prioritizing folks who were under the age of 25 when they were convicted in adult court, where the person is a what's known as a survivor defendant, so was a survivor of sexual or physical violence at the time their crime was committed. And it's my understanding that, you know, there doesn't have to be a direct relationship. For example, that doesn't only apply to folks who, you know, maybe committed a crime against their abuser, but really is more interested in a person's history as a survivor and the ways in which that might have affected their conduct. Deschutes is also prioritizing felony driving while suspended cases where those didn't involve a homicide and there's no other felony convictions. So, you know, that's an example of a county where specific priorities have been identified.
So, Karen, talk about the process. So it starts first with an application.
So the process, again, I feel like I'm beating the same drum here, depends on the county. And so folks need to look carefully at the policy and what's required in the application. But the first step is for the person seeking relief, or if it's available for their agent, to put in an application with the district attorney. In very broad terms, that application needs to set forth a few things. It needs to identify the crime that they're seeking to have reconsidered. It needs to explain why the conviction or sentence no longer advances the interest of justice. And it needs to set forth the relief sought. So this is the crime. It no longer advances the interest of justice because I've been fully rehabilitated. My crime was related to my substance use disorder for which I am in recovery. And this is my plan for staying in recovery if I'm released. And, you know, I have acquired new marketable skills. I will work, you know, and this is, you know, all of those kinds of those would be examples of why my sentence no longer advances the interest of justice. And then includes any information and supporting documents for those arguments. So proof that, again, sticking with the example of substance use disorder that's now being treated. I've been in this program. I've maintained my sobriety for this long. This is the program that I plan to attend upon release. These are the, you know, supporting individuals, and these are letters or affidavits from them attesting that, you know, they are aware of what I've been through, what I've done, and they're committing to assisting or supporting me in these ways. This is my disciplinary record from my time during incarceration, so on and so forth. So that's in very general terms. On a county-by-county basis, some counties have applications which include questions that address some of the kinds of things I was just talking about. Some of them require the submission of certain supporting documents, whether your disciplinary history while incarcerated or the kinds of letters from people who, you know you and support your petition, things like that.
And what issues should a person consider prior to applying? What are the risks?
There are a number of things to consider before applying. And I guess I'll go from maybe most significant to least significant. So most significantly, it is conceivable that in a person's application, they could include information that could be detrimental, harmful to them in some way. So, for example, if in a person's application, they reveal confidential communications they had with their attorney, it is theoretically possible that all of their communications with their lawyer can be waived to their detriment. Similarly, if a person makes a false statement in an application, depending on the circumstances and the decisions of the prosecutor, it could expose them to additional criminal charges. Likewise, if they make admissions to crimes that they now admit to having committed but were never discovered or charged, it's again theoretically possible that that could expose them to additional criminal charges. So those are the most, I think, serious concerns that anyone who's applying should consider. Next is sort of less serious, but kind of psychologically important concerns. And that is, it's going to be a heavy lift to make this application, right? A person needs to secure many documents. They need to fill out somewhat lengthy applications. They need to tell the story of what they did and the circumstances around potentially, you know, assuming that they are in fact guilty of whatever the crime they were convicted of, you know, and have to open up all of that difficulty. The next issue is that it's a heavy lift and will take a lot of effort, energy, and potentially money to obtain all the required documents and exhibits and to make this case. And there's a lot of hope that can develop for people. And there is the risk that all of that effort and that hope will be dashed because relief is just not as available as it might seem. A third risk is that once the application is filed, it's a matter of public record and it can be obtained through a public records request. So people should know that anything that they put down, for example, personal information about the effects of their incarceration on loved ones, that could become a matter of public record if someone were to request the application. So those are the risks that I see here. Also, people aren't entitled to counsel, and there's not, you know, for our organization, for example, doesn't have the resources to provide direct representation to members of the community. And so it's a big undertaking that people will be doing without legal counsel. And so there are all of those risks of, you know, being involved in the system without having legal advice.
Can you talk about expungement? Now, that is another very complicated and long process. And at least there are some clinics out there that are offering expungement service.
The Clear Law Clinic in Portland is a great clinic that helps folks with expungement of their criminal records. You know, I think that's the best one that I'm aware of. As you're saying, expungement is a very confusing process. So the statute essentially, first, you have to know whether or not your crime of conviction is eligible. So no Class A felony convictions are eligible, only if you had a Class A felony charge that was dismissed. And then there's a long list of ineligible conviction types. But assuming that a conviction is eligible for expungement, person must fully complete the sentence, which includes the term of incarceration, any term of probation, and the payment of all fines, fees, and restitution. And I'll say that there are also clinics that help people who can't pay those fines and fees address that issue. Third, for expungement, you have to have no pending criminal cases, and then a period of time must pass from the date of your most recent conviction, whether or not that is the crime you're seeking to have expunged, and that is any conviction anywhere in the United States. So the class of the crime you're seeking to have expunged is what dictates the amount of time that must pass from the completion of the sentence. So if you were convicted of a Class B felony, you have to wait 7 years from the completion of that sentence or any other sentence that occurred after. Class C felony is 5 years, a Class A misdemeanor is 3 years, and Class B or C misdemeanors are 1 year. from the completion of the sentence.
And you said that the Fair Law Project will be tracking the outcomes of Senate Bill 819. So talk a little bit more about that process.
Sure. We're going to be doing public records requests for data relating to how each district attorney office is handling SB 819 applications. We're hoping that district attorneys' offices will just share that information with us without requiring us to go through public records requests, or better yet, make that information public, have a transparent data dashboard that will show the number of 819 applications, breakdowns by crime, breakdowns by information about the person seeking relief based, you know, for example, their age, their race, the crime that they were convicted of, any prior criminal history, et cetera, how much time they served, all of those relevant factors. And then what decisions were made on those applications, and also the amount of time from application to decision. That data collection is really going to let us know whether or not this is a tool that is effective at ensuring that folks who had excessive sentences imposed, unfair sentences imposed, or whose sentences otherwise no longer serve the interests of justice are getting the relief that we think the legislature intended when they passed this bill. And if at the end of 1 year, we're seeing that people aren't really getting any relief, or only a very, very small number of people are getting relief, then we think it's information that the legislature should consider, that the public should understand and also consider and think about whether or not some other mechanism is required to ensure relief.
Now, you did hold one webinar. Will the Fair Law Project continue to hold webinars to explain Senate Bill 819, Karen? And what are the next steps for the legislature or legislation?
So part two of the joint webinar between the Fair Law Project and Don't Shoot Portland will be on June 14th at 5 p.m. We're going to be specifically focused on the mechanics of applying for relief, focusing on Multnomah County's application process. So really a practical look at how one goes through the process if they were convicted in Multnomah County. And we'll see kind of after that whether or not there is additional need from the community for further webinars. If you missed our first webinar, it's posted on OJRC's website and I believe on Don't Shoot Portland's social media streams. I'm not aware of any action right now in the legislature. I think that right now we're just collecting the data, as I mentioned, on the and we're also going to be interested in hearing the stories from people. You know, I applied and this is what happened, or I believe I'm eligible, but I elected not to apply because I don't have the money, or I can't get my documents, or I don't think I'm going to get relief, even though I think I'm entitled to it. You know, those are important stories, too, that often get lost. And we think they're important for the legislature to hear.
And will there be any help for people or adults in custody to help them with filing these applications? That's very difficult to try to gather all these documents that are needed from a prison cell. So will there be volunteers or support within the prison system to help these folks who want to file this application for relief?
The materials that we've put together, we're working with DOC to get them into the law libraries so folks have at least some explanatory materials. I agree with you that obtaining these records and documents is very challenging if you're incarcerated and expensive. And at this point, I'm not aware of any volunteer assistance for that piece. We are hoping to be able to train some private attorneys interested in doing pro bono representation. But at this point, we don't have anything firm that we can announce, and we will update our website if that becomes available.
Karen Neuwirth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I have been speaking with Karen Neuwirth, special counsel with the Fair Law Project of the Oregon Justice Resource Center.